You're listening to the Monster Marathon on the Jack Daniels program from WAKY in Louisville. Thank you and good evening.
Windshield wipers cut eye-shaped arcs through the water sheets that drenched the glass, like rubber fingers wiping tears from a corpse eye. Twin cones of headlight yellow pushed feebly out at the night's blackness and the pouring rain. From the road, I could see the lights of the vacationers' cabins, spots of luminosity dimmed by the mist that rose from the lake. Then the pinpoint lights were gone, and only wet blackness surrounded me, closing in. The moving light from my headlamps, the only evidence of life in a night world of fog and water. The road began to pitch upward, climbing, and I peered ahead and presently saw a dripping sign at the side of the road that read, Weirvale, 1 mile. I grinned at the name. They were going all out in the town to catch their share of summer resort trade from the lake. Weird reports had trickled out from the isolated little hamlet indicating that werewolves prowled the countryside, undoubtedly a publicity trick to trap the interest of the morbidly curious. No one believed the rumors, of course, with the possible exception of those few who believed in the supernatural and horrendous. And though I'd griped about it, my editor had sent me up here to get a tongue-in-cheek angle story for possible publication in the paper's Sunday supplement. Had the weather been good, I'd have considered a break to get away from the hot asphalt blanket of the city. But in the rain and fog, driving along an unknown country road at night wasn't exactly my idea of a vacation. Suddenly, the rain stopped, as though a faucet handle had been turned off by some giant hand hidden in the sky. I braked sharply, feeling the tires skid in mud as a house loomed through the mist at the side of the road. This was the beginning of the village. I turned the wheel and bumped up a rutted driveway toward the house. The weak amber light from inside limed two stolid figures sitting in rockers on the porch. With the rain's end, the original feeling of wry humor with which I had approached this assignment returned. Why not get some fun out of it? In fact, why not do a completely humorous article on the werewolves of Weirvale, I thought. And in this vein, I approached the old couple on the porch. They didn't change the rhythm of their rocking, and their faces remained stolid, expressionless masks, as I smilingly introduced myself and told them of my mission. Where had the werewolves been seen? Who had seen them? I queried for a long, silent moment. Neither spoke, and for one fleeting second, I had the eerie thought that they were lifeless creatures of the fog. Then the man answered, "Ain't werewolves. That's the truth," the woman nodded. "Lies they be," the old man quavered. A swirl of fog shifted between us, and their figures wavered and were momentarily blotted out. I peered through the mist and chuckled. "Then there's no truth to the stories that have come in from this town." The shroud-like vapor parted, and the old man shook his head. "No truth. Lies ain't werewolves." The woman leaned forward slightly, her lipless mouth forming quick spitting words. "Ain't werewolves at all. It's vampires." "That's the truth. Vampires." Her mate nodded vehemently. For a moment, I was wordless. Then the humor of the situation struck me, and I laughed outright. Of course, the old couple were playing part of the game, too. They wanted to reap some of the gain from the horrible hoax. Still laughing, I thanked them, got back into my car, and drove into the heart of the small village. I pulled up in front of a general store, the only building that exhibited any signs of life. Inside, a small, cadaverous man listened to my inquiry about lodging in the town. There was no hotel, he informed me, but there was an old couple who owned a farm up the road who occasionally took in boarders. Further inquiry elicited the fact that the couple he referred to were the old man and woman I had spoken to just a few minutes previously. I asked him if I could leave my car under an overhang attached to the store, and receiving an affirmative, I left, drove the car under the overhang, and began walking the short distance to the farmhouse. A hail from behind turned me as the storekeeper glided by. The man's eyes shifted back and forth and came to rest in the general direction of my face. He leaned forward and whispered, "I shouldn't have told you about them taking in lodgers. Don't go. Listen, I have a bunk behind the store. You can use that. They aren't safe." "What do you mean they aren't safe?" He stared at me and his mouth clamped shut. For a moment we stood still, the fog shifting around our feet. Then I began to grin. It was all part of the same game, the same deception. I turned and continued toward the farmhouse. A hand grabbed my arm, swung me around. The storekeeper's face was close to mine. His breath was foul, and I turned my head to avoid it. "They're werewolves. That's what I mean," he hissed. "Do you understand? They're werewolves." This time I didn't laugh, even though it was still amateurishly funny. I was becoming a little fed up with the whole routine. I pushed his hand away and continued on a bit faster. Foul weather. A bunch of country fools fumbling, pulling a fast one to prey on the thrill-seeker and the morbid-minded to make a quick buck. It wasn't turning out to be the ball I had thought it would be. I'd wrapped it up in the morning and, whoops, hands grabbed my coat from behind again. Insistent now, pulling at me. "Come back with me. You can't go there. They're werewolves." Exasperated, I said tightly, "Let's go," and swung my arm backward viciously to break his clawing hold. He reeled, his feet unsure in the mud, and suddenly he fell, his head hitting a rock with a dull thud. He didn't move. I leaned over him and saw that he was unconscious. Suddenly, I felt ashamed of what I'd done. The old man might be badly hurt. I picked him up in my arms, surprised at his thin lightness, and carried him toward the farmhouse. It was the old man who opened the door for me, the woman standing behind him, staring. I lowered the storekeeper into a musty, lumpy couch. His eyelids fluttered, and he began to move as I turned to the old farmer couple to explain, but they paid no heed, their eyes focused on the mound on the couch. The woman leaned forward and screamed, "Vampire! Filthy, blood-sucking, bad vampire!" Spitting, they began to creep toward the storekeeper. It all seemed so real that for a second I felt the hair on the back of my neck began to rise. Then anger pushed at me. Anger at this farce and the fact that their silly acting had even gotten to me. I grabbed the old man's arm. "Look, I've had just about enough of this crazy business. Let's drop it right now, huh?" I turned to the storekeeper, who stood now in front of the couch. I opened my mouth to say more, but the words never came. Icy hands seemed to move over my flesh, and my mind reeled in shuddering rebellion, for the man was changing before my eyes into a fetid fiend, a bat-like thing, a vampire. The old couple leaped upon the creature as it scuttled toward the door. Like some fantastic alien ballet, they struggled soundlessly for a moment. Then the devilish thing was smashed to the floor, and silently, grimly, the old couple killed it, driving a stake of wood from the fireplace into its heart as it writhed on the treadbare, blood-spattered rug. Shaken, my mind in a staccato daze, I stood there frozen as the old couple came toward me, murmuring soothing words, telling me it was all right now, the vampire's dead. Gently, they took me by the arms and led me to an inner door. The woman whispering, "You must rest now. You've been through a lot. You must rest." The old man opened the door. A flight of rickety steps led down the cobwebbed black maw of a moldy cellar. I turned my head to stammer a protest, but the words froze on my tongue. The old couple were changing. Coarse hair sprouting from their skin pores, their eyes turning yellow, gleaming hungrily between almond lids. Sharp fangs dripped bubbling froth like brew from a witch's cauldron, and a fetid bestial odor clogged my nostrils. With the pungency of decay, I tried to struggle, but their paws tightened like steel bands into my flesh. They pushed and I fell, hurtling down the broken stairs into blackness. The door slammed shut. I was alone in the awful dark, whimpering insane sounds in my mind, a gibbering chaos. I heard a scream. Keening through the black, a high sound flying on wings of torment and insane incoherency. A weird whistle to the hounds of death. And then I knew. The scream was mine, the last poignant cry of a human creature before the mind snapped, before it became a crawling, mindless thing, stirring in the hideous nightmare world of insanity. The scream rose higher, higher, blending with the cosmos, becoming nothing, becoming all. For the most wild, yet most holy narrative which I am about to pen, I neither expect nor solicit belief. Mad indeed would I be to expect it in a case where my very senses reject their own evidence. Yet mad am I not, and very surely do I not dream. But tomorrow I die, and today I would unburden my soul. My immediate purpose is to place before the world plainly and without comment a series of mere household events. In their consequences, these events have terrified, have tortured, have destroyed me. Yet I will not attempt to expound them. To me, they have presented little but horror. To many, they will seem less terrible. Hereafter, perhaps, some intellect may be found which will reduce my phantasms to the commonplace. Some intellect more calm, more logical, and far less excitable than my own, which will perceive in the circumstances I detail with awe nothing more than an ordinary succession of very natural causes and effects. From my infancy, I was noted for the docility and humanity of my disposition. My tenderness of heart was even so conspicuous as to make me the jest of my companions. I was especially fond of animals and was indulged by my parents with a great variety of pets. With these, I spent most of my time and never was so happy as when feeding and caressing them. This peculiarity of character grew with my growth, and in my manhood, I derived from it one of my principal sources of pleasure. To those who have cherished an affection for a faithful and sagacious dog, I need hardly be at the trouble of explaining the nature of the intensity of the gratification thus derivable. There is something in the unselfish and self-sacrificing love of a brute, which goes directly to the heart of him who has had frequent occasion to test the paltry friendship and gossamer fidelity of mere man. I married early, and was happy to find in my wife a disposition not uncongenial with my own. Observing my partiality for domestic pets, she lost no opportunity of procuring those of the most agreeable kind. We had birds, goldfish, a fine dog, rabbits, a small monkey, and a cat. This latter was a remarkably large and beautiful animal, entirely black and sagacious to an astonishing degree. In speaking of his intelligence, my wife, who at heart was not a little tinctured with superstition, made frequent allusion to the ancient popular notion, which regarded all black cats as witches in disguise. Not that she was ever serious upon this point, and I mention the matter at all for no better reason than that it happens just now to be remembered. Pluto, this was the cat's name, was my favorite pet and playmate. I alone fed him, and he attended me wherever I went about the house. It was even with difficulty that I could prevent him from following me through the streets. Our friendship lasted in this matter for several years, during which my general temperament and character, through the instrumentality of the fiend intemperance, had, I blush to confess, experienced a radical alteration for the worse. I grew day by day more moody, more irritable, more regardless of the feelings of others. I suffered myself to use intemperate language to my wife. At length, I even offered her personal violence. My pets, of course, were made to feel the change in my disposition. I not only neglected, but ill-used them. For Pluto, however, I still retained sufficient regard to restrain me from maltreating him, as I made no scruple of maltreating the rabbits, the monkey, or even the dog, when by accident or through affection they came in my way. But my disease grew upon me, for what disease is like alcohol? And at length, even Pluto, who was now becoming old and consequently somewhat peevish, even Pluto began to experience the effects of my ill temper. One night, returning home much intoxicated from one of my haunts about town, I fancied that the cat avoided my presence. I seized him. When, in his fright at my violence, he inflicted a slight wound upon my hand with his teeth, the fury of a demon instantly possessed me, and I knew myself no longer. My original soul seemed at once to take its flight from my body, and a more than fiendish malevolence gingered, thrilling every fiber of my frame. I took from my waistcoat pocket a penknife, opened it, grasped the poor beast by the throat, and deliberately cut one of its eyes from the socket. I blush, I shudder, while I pen the damnable atrocity. When reason returned with the morning, when I had slept the fumes of the night's debauch, I experienced a sentiment half of horror, half of remorse for the crime for which I had been guilty, but it was, at best, a feeble feeling. And the soul remained untouched. I again plunged into excess and soon drowned in wine all memory of the deed. In the meantime, the cat slowly recovered. The socket of the lost eye presented, it is true, a frightful appearance, but he no longer appeared to suffer any pain. He went about the house as usual, but as might be expected, fled in extreme terror at my approach. I had so much of my old heart left as to be at first grieved by this evident dislike on the part of a creature which had once so loved me. But this feeling soon gave place to irritation. And then came, as if to my final and irrevocable overthrow, the spirit of perverseness. Of this spirit, philosophy takes no account. Yet I am not more sure that my soul lives, that I am, that perverseness is one of the primitive impulses of the human heart, one of the indivisible primary faculties or sentiments which give direction to the character of man. Who has not 100 times found himself committing a vile or a stupid action for no other reason than because he knows he should not? Have we not a perpetual inclination in the teeth of our best judgment to violate that which is law merely because we understand it to be such? This spirit of perverseness, I say, came to my final overthrow. It was this unfathomable longing of the soul to vex itself, to offer violence to its own nature, to do wrong for wrong's sake only, that urged me to continue and finally to consummate the injury I had inflicted upon the unoffending brute. One morning in cold blood, I slipped a noose around its neck and hung it to the limb of a tree. Hung it with the tears streaming from my eyes and with the bitterest remorse in my heart. Hung it because I knew that it had loved me and because I felt it had given me no reason of offense. Hung it because I knew that in so doing I was committing a sin, a deadly sin, that would so jeopardize my immortal soul as to place it, if such a thing were possible, even beyond the reach of the infinite mercy of the most merciful and most terrible God. On the night of the day on which this most cruel deed was done, I was aroused from sleep by the cry of fire. The curtains of my bed were in flames. The whole house was blazing. It was with great difficulty that my wife, a servant, and myself made our escape from the conflagration. The destruction was complete. My entire worldly wealth was swallowed up, and I resigned myself thenceforth to despair. I am above the weakness of seeking to establish a sequence of cause and effect between the disaster and the atrocity. But I am detailing a chain of facts and wish not to leave even a possible link imperfect. On the day succeeding the fire, I visited the ruins. The walls, with one exception, had fallen in. This exception was found in a compartment wall, not very thick, which stood about the middle of the house, and against which had rested the head of my bed. The plastering had there, in great measure, resisted the action of the fire, a fact which I attributed to its having been recently spread. About this wall, a dense crowd was collected, and many persons seemed to be examining a particular portion of it with very minute and eager attention. The words strange, singular, and other similar expressions excited my curiosity. I approached and saw, as if graven in vast belief upon the white surface, the figure of a gigantic cat. The impression was given with an accuracy truly marvelous. There was a rope about the animal's neck.
when I first beheld this apparition, for I could scarcely regard it as less. My wonder and my terror were extreme, but at length, reflection came to my aid. The cat, I remembered, had been hung in the garden adjacent to the house. Upon the alarm of fire, this garden had been immediately filled by the crowd, by someone of whom the animal must have cut from the tree and thrown through an open door into my chamber. This had probably been done with the view of arousing me from sleep. The falling of other walls had compressed the victim of my cruelty into the substance of the freshly spread plaster, the lime of which with the flames and the ammonia from the carcass had then accomplished this portraiture as I saw it. Although I thus readily accounted to my reason, if not altogether to my conscience, for the startling fact just detailed, it did not the less fail to make a deep impression upon my fancy. For months I could not rid myself of the phantasms of the cat, and during this period there came back into my spirit a half-sentiment that seemed, but was not, remorse. I went so far as to regret the loss of the animal, and to look about me among the vile haunts which I now habitually frequented for another pet of the same species and of somewhat similar appearance with which to supply its place. One night as I sat, half stupefied in a den of more than infamy, my attention was suddenly drawn to some black object reposing upon the head of one of the immense hogsheads of gin or of rum which constituted the chief furniture of the apartment. I had been looking steadily at the top of this hogshead for some minutes, and what now caused me surprise was the fact that I had not sooner perceived the object. Thereupon, I approached it and touched it with my hand. It was a black cat, a very large one, fully as large as Pluto, and closely resembling him in every respect but one. Pluto had not a white hair upon any portion of his body, but this cat had a large, although indefinite splotch of white, covering nearly the whole region of the breast. Upon my touching him, he immediately arose, purred loudly, rubbed against my hand, and appeared delighted with my notice. This, then, was the very creature of which I was in search. I at once offered to purchase it of the landlord, but this person made no claim to it, knew nothing of it, had never seen it before. I continued my caresses, and when I prepared to go home, the animal evinced a disposition to accompany me. I permitted it to do so, occasionally stooping and patting it as I proceeded. When it reached the house, it domesticated itself at once and became immediately a great favorite with my wife. For my own part, I soon found a dislike to it arising within me. This was just the reverse of what I had anticipated, but I know not how or why it is. Its evident fondness for myself rather disgusted and annoyed me. By slow degree, these feelings of disgust and annoyance rose into the bitterness of hatred. I avoided the creature. A certain sense of shame and the remembrance of my former deed of cruelty prevented me from physically abusing it. I did not, for some weeks, strike or otherwise violently ill-use it. But gradually, very gradually, I came to look upon it with unutterable loathing and to flee silently from its odious presence as from the breath of a pestilence. What added, no doubt, to my hatred of the beast was discovery on the morning after I brought it home that, like Pluto, it also had been deprived of one of its eyes. This circumstance, however, only endeared it to my wife, who, as I have already said, possessed in a high degree that humanity of feeling which had once been my distinguishing trait and the source of many of my simplest and purest pleasures. With my aversion to this cat, however, its partiality for myself seemed to increase. It followed my footsteps with a pertinency which it would be difficult to make the reader comprehend. Whenever I sat, it would crouch beneath my chair or spring upon its knees and jump into my lap, covering me with its loathsome caresses. If I arose to walk, it would get between my feet and thus nearly throw me down, or, fastening its long and sharp claws in my dress, clamber in this manner to my breast. At such times, although I longed to destroy it with a blow, I was yet withheld from so doing, partly by memory of my former crime, but chiefly, let me confess it at once, by absolute dread of the beast. This dread was not exactly a dread of physical evil, and yet I should be so lost how otherwise to define it. I am almost ashamed to own, yes, even in this felon cell, I am almost ashamed to own that the terror and horror with which the animal inspired me had been heightened by one of the merest it would be possible to conceive. My wife had called my attention more than once to the character of the mark of white hair of which I have spoken, and which constituted the sole visible difference between the strange beast and the one I had destroyed. The reader will remember that this mark, although large, had been originally very indefinite, but by slow progress, degrees nearly imperceptible, and which for a long time my reason struggled to reject as fanciful, it had at length assumed a rigorous distinctness of outline. It was now the representation of an object that I shudder to name. And for this, above all, I loathed and dreaded and would have rid myself of the monster had I dared. It was now, I say, the image of a hideous, of a ghastly thing, of the gallows. Oh, mournful and terrible engine of horror and of crime, of agony and of death. And now was I indeed wretched beyond the wretchedness of mere humanity, and a brute beast whose fellow I had contemptuously destroyed, a brute beast to work out for me, a man fashioned in the image of high God, so much of insufferable woe. Alas, neither by day nor by night knew I the blessings of rest anymore. During the former, the creature left me no moment alone. In the latter, I started hourly from dreams of unutterable fear to find the hot breath of the thing upon my face, and its vast weight and incarnate nightmare that I had no power to shake off, incumbent eternally upon my heart. Beneath the pressure of torment such as these, the feeble remnant of the good within me succumbed. Evil thoughts became my sole intimates, the darkest and most evil of thoughts. The moodiness of my usual temper increased to hatred of all things and of all mankind, while from the sudden, frequent, and ungovernable outburst of a fury to which I now blindly abandoned myself, my uncomplaining wife, alas, was the most usual and most patient of sufferers. One day she accompanied me upon some household errand into the cellar of the old building, which our poverty compelled us to inhabit. The cat followed me down the steep stairs and, nearly throwing me headlong, exasperated me to madness, uplifting an axe and forgetting in my wrath the childish dread which had hitherto stayed my mind. I aimed a blow at the cat, which of course would have proved instantly fatal had it descended as I wished, but this blow was arrested by the hand of my wife. Goaded by the interference into a rage more than demoniacal, I withdrew my arm from her grasp and buried the axe in her brain. She fell dead upon the spot without a groan. This hideous murder accomplished, I set myself forthright and with entire deliberation to the task of concealing the body. I knew that I could not remove it from the house, either by day or by night, without the risk of being observed by the neighbors. Many projects entered my mind. At one period, I thought of cutting the corpse into minute fragments and destroying them by fire. At another, I resolved to dig a grave for it in the floor of the cellar. Again, I deliberated about casting it into the well in the yard, about packing it in a box as if merchandise with the usual arrangement, and so getting a porter to take it from the house. Finally, I hit upon what I considered a far better expedient than either of these. I determined to wall it up in the cellar, as the monks of the Middle Ages had recorded to have walled up their victims. For a purpose such as this, the cellar was well adapted. Its walls were loosely constructed and had lately been plastered throughout with a rough plaster, which the dampness of the atmosphere had prevented from hardening. Moreover, in one of the walls was a projection caused by a false chimney or fireplace that had been filled up and made to resemble the rest of the cellar. I made no doubt that I could readily displace the bricks at this place, insert the corpse, and wall the whole up as before, so that no eye could detect anything suspicious. And in this calculation, I was not deceived. By means of a crowbar, I easily dislodged the bricks, and having carefully deposited the body against the inner wall, I propped it in that position, while with little trouble I relayed the whole structure as it originally stood. Having procured mortar, sand, and hair with every possible precaution, I prepared a plaster which would not be distinguished from the old, and with this I very carefully went over the new brickwork. When I had finished, I felt satisfied that all was right. The wall did not present the slightest appearance of having been disturbed. The rubbish on the floor was picked up with the minutest care. I looked about triumphantly and said to myself, "Here at last." Then, my labor has not been in vain. My next step was to look for the beast which had been the cause of so much wretchedness, for I had at length firmly resolved to put it to death. Had I been able to meet with it at the moment, there could have been no doubt of its fate, but it appeared that the crafty animal had been alarmed at the violence of my previous anger and forbore to present itself in my present mood. It is impossible to describe or to imagine the deep, the blissful sense of relief which the absence of the detested creature occasioned in my bosom. It did not make its appearance during the night, and thus, for one night at least, since its introduction into the house, I soundly and tranquilly slept. I slept, even with the burden of murder upon my soul. The second and the third day passed, and still my tormentor came not. Once again I breathed as a free man. The monster in terror had fled the premises forever. I should behold it no more. My happiness was supreme. The guilt of my dark deed disturbed me very little. Some few inquiries had been made, but these had been readily answered. Even a search had been instituted, but of course nothing was to be discovered. I looked upon my future as secured. Upon the fourth day of the assassination, a party of the police came very unexpectedly into the house and proceeded again to make rigorous investigation of the premises. Secure, however, in the inscrutability of my place of concealment, I felt no embarrassment whatever. The officers bade me accompany them in their search. They left no nook or corner unexplored. At length, for the third or fourth time, they descended into the cellar. I quivered not a muscle. My heart beat calmly as that of one who slumbers in innocence. I walked the cellar from end to end. I folded my arms upon my bosom and roamed easily to and fro. The police were thoroughly satisfied and prepared to depart. The glee at my heart was too strong to be restrained. I burned to say, if but one word, by way of triumph and to render doubt they sure their assurance of my guiltlessness. "Gentlemen," I said at last, as the party ascended the steps, "I delight to have allayed your suspicions. I wish you all health and a little more courtesy. By the by, gentlemen, this is a very well-constructed house." In the rabid desire to say something easily, I scarcely knew what I uttered at all. "I may say, an excellently well-constructed house. These walls, are you going, gentlemen? These walls are solidly put together. And here, through the mere frenzy of bravado, I rapped heavily with a cane which I held in my hand upon the very position of the brickwork behind which stood the corpse of the wife of my bosom. But may God shield and deliver me from the fangs of the art fiend." No sooner had the reverberation in my blows sunk into silence than it was answered by a voice from within the tomb. By a cry at first muffled and broken like the sobbing of a child, and then quickly swelled into one long, loud, and continuous scream, utterly inhuman. A howl, a wailing shriek, half of horror and half of triumph, such as might have arisen only out of hell, conjointly from the throats of the damned in their agony and of the demons that exult in the damnation. Of my own thoughts, it is folly to speak. Swooning, I staggered to the opposite wall. For one instant, the party on the stairs remained motionless, through extremity of terror and awe. In the next, a dozen stout arms were toiling at the wall. It fell bodily. The corpse, already greatly decayed and clotted with gore, stood erect before the eyes of the spectators. Upon its head, with red, extended mouth and solitary eye of fire, sat the hideous beast whose craft had seduced me into murder and whose informing voice had consigned me to the hangman. I had walled the monster up.